Thanks a lot, Todd. I think I face a bigger challenge than Natalie, because now I have to follow both Natalie and Mark. Very intimidating to follow these two outstanding talks. I want to first introduce the co-author on this presentation, Nikola Heslow. He was a PhD student working in my program a couple of years ago. He's now back in France working for Lima Green in their bioinformatics division. I'm going to briefly talk about some of the challenges we're looking at, an overview, a very brief overview of genomic selection, and then some of the work on characterizing genotype by environment interaction using markers, and then wrap up with Nicola's work on integrating a crop model into the genomic selection framework. Duke Pauly and Mike Gore, Duke's in the audience here, shared this figure from a recent publication that they have in plant physiology. And this illustrates the process which, in which genotype by environment by management interact to produce the phenotype, and also how you can use field-based high-throughput phenotyping together with envirotyping, crop models, and genomic models to predict a phenotype. Combining genomic models that capture additive effects with crop models can possibly allow you to facilitate the modeling of non-additive effects and genotype by environment interaction to to improve prediction accuracy of modeled phenotypes. And you heard a lot about that from Mark's talk. Genomic selection was first reported in the literature in 1998 by Haley and Fisher, and then later elaborated in the context of a dairy breeding program by Mewison, Hayes, and Goddard in 2001. We think about genomic selection in the context of two different kinds of populations: a training population, which is genotyped with a large number of markers covering the whole genome, and that is then evaluated in your target population of environments. We assume that there is at least one marker in linkage disequilibrium with each gene controlling the trait. And we treat those effects as random effects in a model where they're fitted simultaneously to try to estimate the total, the breeding value of the individual. The other population, which we refer to as the breeding population or selection candidates, are typically genotyped but not necessarily phenotyped. We use our prediction model to predict the breeding value of the individuals in that population, and then that allows us to do multiple cycles of selection without phenotyping. This figure illustrates how those two populations work together. The training population is typically composed of elite breeding lines and germplasm. They're evaluated in a target population of environments, and that data is then used to train your prediction model that is used in combination with genotypes from either new germplasm or from genotypes from your crossing program. The genomic estimated breeding values are then used to select those individuals to recycle in your crossing program or move them into your advanced testing program. And finally, once you've evaluated those materials in your multiple environment testing program, those can then be recycled in the training population to update your prediction model. There are a number of factors that affect genomic selection accuracy, and those include linkage disequilibrium, sample size, marker type and density, model, and most importantly, the relationship between the training population and the breeding population. Just like phenotypic selection, heritability also affects the accuracy of your prediction models. So traditionally, multiple linear regression was used in combination with markers that were declared significant according to some arbitrary significance threshold, And that has the disadvantage that you tend to overestimate the significant marker effects, and you miss those small effects which slip below the significance threshold. Currently, models such as your linear mixed models, the Bayesian estimation, and machine learning allow you to combine all of the markers in the model because you don't have to test for significance, and those are estimated as random effects simultaneously. Probably the most common model that is used in the literature is the ridge regression best linear unbiased prediction. This particular model assumes an equal variance of all the marker effects and equally shrinks all marker effects towards zero. Other models include the Bayesian models. The original models published by Mewison et al. Include Bayes A and Bayes B. Bayes A and Bayes B use an inverse chi-square prior on the marker variances and allows you to estimate the variances for each individual marker. And Bayes A uses all the markers, whereas Bayes B uses a variable selection parameter that automatically assigns the value of zero to some of the markers that are have very small effects. The Bayesian lasso model has a doubled exponential distribution so that it causes more emphasis on markers with large effects, and it shrinks those markers with small effects more towards zero. And then a couple of non-parametric models include reproducing kernel-Hilbert spaces regression. This particular model uses a Gaussian kernel and a smoothing parameter to control the distribution of the QTL effects. And then lastly, Random Forest is a machine learning algorithm that's been used extensively in genomic selection models. And it uses a set of regression trees grown on samples of observations using a random set of predictors. And then those predictions are averaged over the different trees. The first project that I'll tell you about that Nicola worked on was using a sample, a data set consisting of almost 1,000 barley lines grown in 58 environments throughout Europe. It was a highly unbalanced data set, which is typical of a breeding program. Only 18 of the genotypes were present in more than 50% of the environments. He used a Bayesian lasso model to estimate the marker effects, and then he characterized the allele effects for each test location. And the goal here was to identify the outlier environments and group relevant mega environments. So in this highly unbalanced data set, what you have is marker effects in each of the environments. And so that creates what is a balanced data set because all the marker effects appeared in all the environments. This allows you to calculate Euclidean distances based on those marker effects to determine which environments are more similar to others. And in this figure, in this heat map, shows you that where the blue squares are located, those environments were more similar to each other. Where the pink and the red environments are, those were outlier environments, and they were unrelated. The marker effects were less similar to the marker effects in the other locations. A similar heat map, but this time based on the reciprocal prediction accuracy between pairwise environments, shows a less consistent pattern, but when these were grouped into six different groups, it did increase the prediction accuracy, and so this was effective at improving the prediction accuracy overall of the environments. Another experiment was to try to optimize the composition of the training population by selecting subsets of environments that were more predictive than others. In this experiment, the genomic selection model was, in each environment, was trained for each environment, and then the mean prediction accuracy for that environment with the other 57 environments was computed, and they were ranked from lowest to highest prediction accuracy. And then one environment at a time was removed, starting with the least predictive environment, and that was moved into an unpredictive set. And then the model was retrained on the predictive set of environments that remained. The model was then run on the unpredictive set to determine if some useful information had been moved to the unpredictive set. This figure shows the results of that analysis, and the red red circles are the predictive set, the blue triangles are the unpredictive set, and the green squares are the validation set. You can see that in the predictive set, as he removed one environment at a time, the prediction accuracy rose from 0.54 to 0.61 until about 18 environments were removed. When those unpredictive environments were removed to the unpredictive set, the prediction accuracy had a slight increase in the beginning, and then it plateaued to about the same place where the prediction accuracy in the predictive set started to decline. So that means that the 40 remaining environments were the optimum set of environments for maximizing a prediction accuracy in this data set. I should say that we saw a similar pattern in the validation set, but the increase in the accuracy was not statistically significant. Mark did a wonderful job of describing the uses and parameterization of crop models, and this is just a generic diagram of a crop model. In this project, Nicola was integrating environmental covariates and crop modeling into the genomic selection network framework to predict genotype by environment interaction. The goal was to predict genotype by environment interaction and try to increase the prediction accuracy. The second objective was to model the genome-wide markers and their differential response to the environment to try to better understand the genetic architecture of genotype by environment interaction. The data set that was used for this project involved 2,400 elite wheat lines from Lima Green, Europe. They were grown in 44 environments over 6 years throughout France. That generated over 9,000 mean grain yields with a heritability of about 0.54. They were genotyped with a 1,200 SNP chip array, and the weather data came from a database called AgriForecast, which is a European database consisting of climatic data interpolated over a 25-kilometer grid. The crop model used in this case was called Sirius Quality. So the crop model was used to compute the phenology, and this is important for synchronizing the developmental stages of different wheat varieties with the climatic variables at a particular point in time. We had three different classes of maturity, early, medium, and late, and those were adjusted, those were matched up to the climatic data at a particular stage of development. We derived environmental stress covariates by developmental stage using knowledge from the literature, and the development stages and the stresses are shown in this figure down below. We ended up with a total of 101 stress covariates. These are actually the stress, the climatic variables at a specific developmental stage. These were used as independent variables in the statistical models for effect estimation and prediction. So the factorial regression model was extended to the genomic selection context for each marker. Each marker was fit a main effect and a sensitivity to each of the environmental stress covariates. The environments were split into two, and that consisted of 22 training and 22 validation sets. And these were used to validate in an unbiased way the different models that were tested. The main machine learning algorithm called soft rule fit was used to try to capture that interaction between the markers and the stress covariates and nonlinearity. Soft rule fit is a machine learning algorithm that uses ensemble learning By generating a large number of predictors built on bootstrap sampling of observations, and these predictors are combined by averaging or by penalized regression. This was a methodology that was published by Friedman and Popescu in 2008. So the performance was predicted as a mean effect plus the G by E deviation. We had over 1,200 markers and 101 stress covariates, so obviously this is going to present a computational challenge. So the way we dealt with the dimensionality was we looked at the variance of markers across the environments. And what we found was that more than half of the markers had an importance different from zero. We evaluated all of these in a model. Of those markers, the marker for the photoperiod insensitivity gene had the highest variance, but alone it did not capture a significant part of the G by E. We also had markers for major genes, including vernalization genes and dwarfing genes, but those did not capture a significant amount of variation. So we looked at the prediction accuracy, the mean prediction accuracy for different numbers of markers and different rule fit levels, and what we found was that the optimal model was with 250 markers and rule fit level 4. And that generated a 11% increase in accuracy and a 10% decrease in the coefficient of variability of the estimates. This figure shows 8 of the 10 stress covariants that were significant based on permutation. The most important environmental covariant was the average daily temperature from meiosis to flowering. Also, early spring drought measured by two different measures of stress were significant: heat stress before flowering and heat stress during early grain fill. All of the stress covariates were included in the soft rule fit terms, and this is a reflection of the complexity of the different kinds of genotype by environment responses. One of the interesting things about being able to predict genotype by environment interaction in unobserved environments is that now you can generate a balanced set of those G by E terms. And when you have a balanced set, again, you can calculate Euclidean distances and allows you to cluster environments based on that variation and actually investigate something about the target population environments. So these environments were clustered according to the Ward's clustering algorithm, and what you can see is that in most cases the environments grouped by year, but there was a significant north-south trend, and this genotype by environment correlation matrix corresponds to the genetic correlation among the environments. So this figure illustrates the prediction accuracy with and without the G by E term. A dot above the line shows that the genotype by environment term improved the accuracy of the model. And what you can see is that in many cases, including the genotype by environment interaction term, improved the accuracy. But you also notice that when you have a model that had poor prediction accuracy without the G by E, including the G by E term actually was more effective in improving the prediction accuracy. So overall, the mean accuracy improved by 11%, the coefficient of variability decreased by 10%, and this approach allows us to leverage our knowledge about the physiology and agronomy. It allows us to use existing breeding data, and it's a model that we can interpret in a way so that we can know what stresses are most important in our target population environment and design our breeding program with germplasm that can address those kinds of stresses. So to summarize, the model was able to predict part of the genotype by environment response in unobserved environments. The gain in prediction accuracy was significant and was greater than or equal to previous publications by Pergagno et al. The crop growth model provides for generality by condensing climatic variables into a few covariates and relating them to plant stresses. The statistical model brings in the prediction accuracy, and by combining those, we can predict genotype performance in environments of interest, which are those of the future. This approach can provide insight into the genetic architecture controlling genotype by environment interaction. So some of the things that we're looking for the future in genomic selection research is to, first of all, try to figure out ways to optimize the integration of genomic selection into breeding programs. And because breeding programs are so diverse and different crops have different requirements, this is going to require a lot of thought and simulation to be able to figure out optimal ways to integrate. Just a reminder that we need to use correlated traits to improve the prediction accuracy of our models. And the high-throughput phenotyping traits are very promising for integration with the genomic prediction. And finally, combining association analysis with crop modeling with genomic prediction opens up the black box for understanding the genetic architecture and genotype by environment interaction. I need to acknowledge a number of funding sources, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and in particular the USDA, for funding the coordinated agriculture projects, including the wheat applied genomics, and improving barley and wheat germplasm for changing environments, and also for the National Needs Fellowships for Elliot Hefner and Jessica Rakowski. Lima Grain provided the support for Nicola Heslow. So I'll stop there, and I'd be glad to try to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
So if the Mark and Talia, could you come up? And we're going to open it up. If anyone has any questions, we'll open up for a discussion. What I do ask is that you try and use the microphone in the middle of the room, and someone please turn it on, the first person who grabs the mic. Unfortunately, you're going to have to go to this mic, I think. They didn't put a mic on the table today. Anyone have a question out there? Okay, I see one coming. There's a button on the side of it. Just push it up.
So, it could be. It's not something that I'm specifically interested in as such, but Charlie and others have interests in those areas. And I think that manipulating the management doesn't necessarily need to only require you to have the weather forecasting if you understand something about the genetics that you're actually bringing along. So, for example, if you work, in the West, a lot of the growers are very reluctant to increase plant population. A lot of that's based on experience with some of the older genetics. But if you actually look at the the hybrid by density interactions, and you look at the older versus the newer germplasm, you actually see that some of that newer germplasm doesn't interact as much and it has more consistency of performance as you go to those higher densities. So you can actually use that. And one of the other ways we've used it is actually in our managed environment testing, is to generate a wider range of soil water balance situations. So instead of just taking at a given density the environment that you actually get, you can actually shift quite dramatically the water balance situation by in the order of 40 millimeters of water, depending on the genetics. And 40 millimeters of water, it can be life or death for hybrids that are transpiring 4 to 5 millimeters of water a day. And so it can have quite a strong effect as well. So understanding all of that, I think, sort of is a repeatable predictor that growers have some ability to manipulate in combination with an understanding of genetics to be more predictive without necessarily having to have early year forecasting opportunities. In other situations, having that forecasting opportunity may actually be more relevant for completely changing your genetics, because if at the start of the year someone said to me, this is going to be a really good 2015 type year rather than the 2012 year, I'd flip my genetics quite significantly.
I didn't do a very good job of describing. We actually collect quite a bit of information. Each cooperator fills out information about planting date, harvesting date, fertilizer, planting density, equipment used, all kinds of inputs that are used for each growing season. All of that information is collected. We collect environmental information, as I mentioned, with weather stations that are consistent across all locations, and then we do soil sampling before or early season and end of the season soil samples. Not in this initial but that is a plan to incorporate some of that information as well. Great question. So we have interacted quite a bit with the private sector, and have gotten a lot of input and ideas for how to, different paths and in things that we could test with the platform. They have been very generous in the sense that they have provided the ability to use their locations if we were interested in. Becomes a little bit difficult because we want to be able to go into their fields and get specific measurements ourselves, and there are some safety restrictions and things like that. So we haven't really explored it, but we are in constant interactions with the public sector folks and getting quite a bit of input, including the guy sitting right here. Thank you.
You mean what impact genetic gain has in improving predictability? How much genetic gain it has impacted?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, so we've quantified that, for example. So these methods were used sort of to help us develop and launch the Aquamax product, so we've directly measured how much realized on-farm gain and sort of published that. Sort of a view of that in a paper in Crop Science that Jim Gaffney was the first author on that paper. It sort of documented for the first generation Aquamax products. And so the key thing about those were that they were products that were already in sort of the development process just as we were implementing this. So it was sort of like an accelerated gain of prioritizing those products. Now we've sort of got a second generation coming through where you've recycled and developed the new parents from those. And so we're in a process of quantifying that as we look at genetic gain in general to all of our different target environments. So we are. We're monitoring that. And also, in addition to the gain, you're also looking at the investment that's behind that as well. And I think that comes back to some of the things Mark was talking about, that once you know it works, you then really focus a lot on optimizing how to sort of best implement it inside those breeding programs.
So I think that is a little bit of what I was referring to when I said about the evolutionary biologists' view of GBIE. When they think about plasticity, they start thinking about allelic effect. So is the GBIE caused by pleiotropic effects that, you know, in certain environments, genes will be expressed in certain ways versus others. So they talk about antagonistic pleiotropy, or they talk about significant differences in the additive effect. And it is a little, you know, you have to have the right population to actually be able to dissect it. But, you know, in a population where you have a fairly uniform background in single, sort of single gene type situations that then are exposed to different environmental activities, you can start dissecting that. And that is one of the things that we have been talking about in the framework of the Genomes to Fields, that it is something that it is important. And in my presentation, trying to describe this work of trying to say what are the types of genes that actually control GBIE. And that is what I mean, evolutionary biology's view of it. So you just need the right population to do it. It's easy. I mean, it's kind of easy to think about it theoretically. It's not easy to come up with the right population, primarily if you think about evaluating hybrids, which is what would be meaningful, for example, in the case of maize. You could come up with a set of isogenic lines that you could put in the environment, but is that really meaningful in terms of measuring, for example, yield and the effect of the environment on these allelic changes? So. Not sure if I answer your question. I mean, I've thought about it quite a bit. I'm thinking about what is the right population to be able to do it. So, thank you for the question, though. I asked that same question to the grad student that generated the figures last night, and I am waiting for the email. Just kidding. There is a mix of both. There are some of those peaks that are in regions that you would expect to see some associations, and there are some others that there is nothing that we really. But we haven't really dig into it to really understand. understand it. So I don't think I can give a very good answer to your question. But very good point, though.
I'm deaf. So you have to say it again a little bit louder.
So for the education population, there's a gross representation of the information.
Sorry, I'm just not hearing you properly. Help that. In the validation population, there's what? Okay, so I think I understand what you're asking. So this is sort of one of the, if I understand your question correctly, I'll give you an answer that I think is really relevant, and if I get it wrong, you can say, no, that's not what I asked, and you get it. So one of the things that's really interesting is that in terms of developing the crop growth model, what we're doing is we're actually using that as the likelihood function, okay? And the detailed work is actually in building the right functional relationships inside there. And then what we're doing is we're measuring enough of the target populations that we're actually able to set up the priors that we're sampling from to have the initial set of values for the gene effect that are then tested with the crop growth model to predict yield. So ultimately, what we're doing is, and so as a practical application of this, is we're really focusing on high-quality yield data and ensuring that we're able to actually predict yield using the estimated genetic effects, using the crop growth model to actually predict the yield for those genotypes. And so in the actual experimental situation, you do not have to measure every trait on every genotype to actually implement the method. You've just got to have enough understanding of your populations to be able to actually set up your priors, and then you've got to have something that you think is relevant, that's influenced by those traits, yield in this case, that you're going to judge whether or not your predictions are actually meeting some target criteria to move those from sort of samples from the priors into the approximate posterior distribution that you're actually setting up for a prediction. Within that posterior distribution that you actually set up, you can actually go back and infer and predict back into your population those things, with what you expect those trait values to actually be based on that sampled model. And if you want to, you can actually go back and test that. One of the other things that we're actually looking at is extending this into the multi-trait situation to say which of these traits are most informative and how would you use that to complement and improve on just the yield prediction. So there is that piece. So in terms of the traits, for the practical application, you don't have to measure all of these traits in your multi-environment trial to actually apply this. Okay. That may not be the question you're asking, but that's what I thought you were asking. Okay, thanks. I think that's a definite possibility because, you know, the model is not set up generically to work on every trait all of the time. And for different populations, you're actually going to get different amounts of information on the relevant diversity. That may actually help you with understanding how to better parameterize some of the traits. And it may also that by predicting back into those traits and then testing may actually tell you something about how you might actually want to better measure those traits so that you're able to better parameterize the crop growth model as well. So Absolutely. It's sort of that iterative modeling approach is definitely a critical part of this, that not only is it a prediction, but it actually tells you something about how you have to refine the model the next time, and also how you may better have to parameterize some of these components. Yep.